More than 3,300 years, the Jewish people have preserved and transmitted their wisdom about how to live life. From generation to generation, parents taught their children, teachers taught their students, in a living chain that stretches back to the giving of that great wisdom in the Sinai Desert. Perhaps never has there been a generation more desperately in need of this ancient wisdom. A wisdom today made available to the English-speaking world by scholars like Lawrence Kellerman. Sit back and enjoy while Lawrence Kellerman takes you on an adventure into the world of ancient wisdom for modern minds.
We are very, very privileged to have with us here this morning Lawrence Kellerman. He is a world-renowned lecturer. In fact, he has just returned from a 10-city tour of the United States, one of many tours he takes throughout the course of the year. He is truly a man who needs little introduction. He has done a tremendous amount of work exploring religions, comparative religion. Obviously, Judaism is a pet project of his. And we'll
okay, good morning. I want to present you this morning with a question which I personally confronted recently, and the conclusions that I came to, and then perhaps later on you'll be able to share with me whether you agree with those conclusions or disagree. There's a passage in the Talmud, in the Gemara Sanhedrin, that describes the coming of the Messiah. And the Gemara there says that the Messiah can come in one of two possible scenarios. The Gemara says either the Messiah will come to a generation which is entirely righteous, or the Messiah will come to a generation which is entirely corrupt. In other words, what's going to happen is either Jewry will return en masse to the Torah. They will use it to morally transform mankind, and the Messiah will arrive to congratulate us. Or the other nightmarish scenario is that Jewry will entirely abandon the Torah. They'll be swallowed up in a riptide of burgeoning assimilation. Mankind, who were supposed to transform, will roll completely out of control. And ultimately, the Messiah will have to arrive to rescue us from our own homemade hell. Personally, I think I might understand the latter scenario very well. When I travel around the world today, what do I see? So rates of white-collar and blue-collar crime have never been higher in the quote-unquote civilized world. This last century's three most famous atheists, Mao Zedong, Stalin, and Hitler, killed more people than were destroyed by the Crusades, the Inquisition, and the Jihad combined throughout all of human history. Today, the most inhuman practices of torture are methodically being practiced all across the planet. At this moment, the most horrible forms of abject torture are being practiced on innocent human beings all across the planet. And even the most civilized nations fail to provide any sort of haven from the world's spiraling malevolence. For example, today, a child born anywhere in the United States of America has, on average, a 1 in 200 chance of being murdered during his or her lifetime. A child born in high crime areas, in certain cities, Atlanta, Philadelphia, have a 1 in 50 chance of being murdered during their lifetime. In the Tenderloin and Fillmore areas near San Francisco, the chances are 1 in 70 of being murdered at some point during their lifetime. And rates of crimes, quote unquote, less serious than murder, like rape, are 4 times higher throughout the United States than murder. Selfishness is ubiquitous among the non-criminal. rates of spousal abuse, divorce, child abuse are at epidemic levels throughout the first world. Not too long ago, one state in the U.S., Oregon, passed a law which allows a patient to sign consent forms, which have to be co-signed by two physicians, which then allow these two physicians to put this patient out of his misery, legalize euthanasia. And if that is not frightening, then consider the following. As a result of that law that was recently passed in Oregon, HMOs across the United States are now counseling to determine exactly how to lobby for similar laws in their states because of the millions this will save them in providing health care. Private industries and governments around the world provide the most destructive and the most despicable services and products for the right price. And according to the latest statistics, Jewry, who was supposed to serve as a light unto the nations and rescue mankind from this disaster, are in the middle of committing sociological and demographic suicide. When God looks down on the planet, who does he see even cares about the problem? Who does he see is thinking about the problem today? So I think I understand how theoretically the Talmud's latter scenario, the scenario of the Messiah coming to greet a generation which is totally corrupt, could take place. But what were the sages of the Talmud thinking when they suggested that the Messiah could come to greet a generation which is totally righteous? And I'll go even a step further. Not only what were they thinking, but I need to confess what I'm thinking. Because if I had to guess today which scenario it's going to be, will it be the dark scenario or the bright one? If I had to guess, given the way the world looks right now, it's fairly clear to me, in fact, in my mind, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the Messiah is going to come to greet a generation which will be entirely righteous. So what am I thinking? So I'll tell you my calculations, and you'll tell me if you think I'm making a mistake. There's a principle that's described in the Talmud, it's brought down by the Jewish sages, that one's spiritual power, your ability to make a punch, to make a dent in this world, is not determined by your external achievements. Your spiritual power in this world is determined by how hard you struggle to do the right thing. How much of an effort you make forward to stand up and step forward to do the right thing under difficult circumstances. There's a passage in the Medrash, a very famous passage. It reads as follows. It's based on a verse in Koheles. The verse says like this: don't say, what happened to this generation? For the previous generations were much better than these. Don't say such a thing. Why? So Rav Brachia in the Talmud quotes this verse. Yehoyada was a teacher of Aharon. Who's Yehoyada and who's Aharon? Aharon, of course you know, is Moshe's brother. Moshe's brother lived in 1400 BCE. Yehoyada, the verse says, was a teacher of Aharon. Yehoyada lived in 950 BCE, about 350 years after Aharon. Yehoyada was a teacher of Aharon. Yehoyada lived 350 years after the man he taught. What does the verse mean when it says Yehoyada was a teacher of Aharon? The Midrash says, if Aaron would have been alive 350 years later. During Yehoyada's generation, Aaron would have bent his knees and learned from Yehoyada, for Yehoyada was so much greater than Aaron. Now, how can that be? I mean, historically, when you see what Aaron, he was the high priest of the Jewish nation as they were launched in the generation of the Torah, when the Torah was given. If you look at what Aaron achieved, it was immense. Yehoyada, you've probably never heard of him before. His achievements were minuscule compared to what Aaron did. And yet, here our sages say, Yehoyada was much greater. Why? Because he lived in a much darker generation, and the struggle was much more difficult. And someone's spiritual power is not determined by what they do externally. It's determined by how hard you work, whether or not you're willing to step forward. I have in front of me a transcript of a document, which my guess is there is not a single person in this room who has ever seen. It's an extraordinarily rare document. Once upon a time, about 500 years ago, there was a great sage who lived, who was popularly known today as the Arizal. He was one of the greatest Kabbalists who ever lived, the Arizal. The Arizal had a student whose name was Rabbi Chaim Vital, also a great Kabbalist. Most rabbis don't realize that Rabbi Chaim Vital kept a diary of sorts. And in this diary, he recorded word for word conversations that he had with his Rebbe, his teacher, the Arizal. I have in front of me a transcript of one of their conversations. Okay, now, as you listen to this transcript, you have to understand, our tradition says the Arizal was on such a high spiritual level, at night he used to learn with angels. They used to come and they used to sit across from him and teach him Torah. So you're talking about a man at an incredible level. What happens when the scene opens? Rav Chaim Vital, the student, says to his Rebbe, who used to learn with angels, Rebbe, why do you keep saying that my soul is so high that I'm such a polished human being? Behold, Rebbe, you know that the smallest individual in previous generations was so righteous and so saintly that I do not reach up to his ankle in my achievements. Answered the Arizal, Reb Chaim, you should know, the greatness of a soul does not depend on the external acts that a person does. Rather, it's a function of the time and the generation that they live in. For a very small act of righteousness in this generation outweighs the greatest mitzvahs that were done by the greatest sages of previous generations. Why? Because in this generation, he said 500 years ago, in a generation where people learned with angels, in this generation, he said, the darkness is very thick, and it triumphs. And in previous generations, it was very bright. If 500 years ago, the darkness was very thick, and in that generation, people still learned with angels, then how would we describe the darkness in a generation like this? Where the best we can do is bang away at books and pray that we have some understanding of what our sages said in previous generations. And even then we know we don't understand most of what they said. What do we say about a generation who, because of the Holocaust, was entirely deprived of their sages? We have the barest understanding of Torah, no understanding of how human beings actually function. What do you say about the darkness in a generation like this? It's true that the Baal Shem Tov, the Vilna Gaon, the Arizal, they failed to bring the Messiah. It's true that Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Code of Jewish Law, failed to bring the Messiah. It is true that Ravina and Ravashi, the authors of the Gemara, failed to bring the Messiah. Rav Yehuda Nasi, the author of the Mishnah, failed to bring the Messiah. Yechezkel, Isaiah, Elisha, the greatest prophets, failed to bring the Messiah. Is it inconceivable that you or I could bring the Messiah? Well, it depends on how hard you're willing to sweat. That's what the Talmud says. If I'm not incorrect, I believe the people in this room are not getting academic credit, so to speak, for sitting here right now. And my guess is you probably made a lot more during your winter break working at another job rather than coming on this trip. Perhaps there was no skiing in Utah, right? Weather was cold in Hawaii. What on earth are you doing here? You took off a week, 2 weeks of your life to come and learn about Judaism and heroism and your place in history and the potentials that you have and what you could accomplish. What is that worth in a generation like this where the only thing that someone's concerned about is are they going to get the Koro fellowships or what their salary is going to be at their first starting job? What does it mean when you take off time and invest energy, give over your life to making a difference? What does it mean when you step forward? Another personal confession. I have, say it straight, I have very few people that I consider to be close friends. Because I'm picky. I have a certain picture of the people that I would like to draw close to me. Now, I want close friends very, very badly, and I've made a point of collecting them. And I travel the world collecting people who I would like to stand next to me and inspire me. Two of my closest friends I met in the summer of 1981. I was on a summer leadership program. A group of 80 students got together to discuss how to make a better world. They were selected from English-speaking countries from all over the world. And we all came together and we spent a month on an isolated campus talking about what could be done, what should be done. And not surprisingly, there I found a couple of people I could relate to. I met a girl, Hannah, who I married. That's one of my best friends. And I met a fellow whose name is Alex, who I have admiration for that is beyond words. And I am so proud to call him my friend. At the end of that summer, Khan and I spoke, and we decided Judaism has got something to say about how to make a better world, and we want to find out what. And my wife and I got on a plane, we left the United States, we came to Israel. We sat in yeshiva, and we learned about the sort of refinement that the Torah can create in a human being. It was a life-transforming experience. At the same time that my wife and I got up and went to yeshiva, Alex, because he's truly a hero, said, I'm going to Israel as well. He came to Israel. He arrived in Israel. He made Aliyah when he arrived. There was no time to wait. As he was making Aliyah, he said to the Aliyah agents, I'd like to be drafted into the army. They said, well, you don't worry. They're not going to bother you for 3 years. He said, bother. That's why I came. I came to save Jewish lives. Take me. So they said, well, you know, we can't do anything for you. You'll have to go protest with the army. As far as we're concerned, you have 3 years. He went down. He beat the doors of the army down until eventually they said to him, within a few weeks, they said, fine, we'll take you. They gave him a test. He has flat feet and asthma. They said to him, "You're excused." He said, "I want into the army." They said, "You'll die." He said, "I want into the army." They said, "Now you're excused because you're crazy." He fought his way into the Israeli troops. As soon as he was accepted into the army, he immediately started protesting he wanted to get into the paratroops. They laughed at him. He fought and fought and fought until my best friend, my hero, stepped forward into a group of paratroopers. When he got into the paratroops, he immediately protested, "I want to enroll in an officer's course." They said to him, "You just joined." He fought his way into an officer's course, became an officer in the paratroops. Then he applied to join one of the elite, the crack units that does the Entebbe-type missions. My best friend, my hero, made it into the troop he wanted to make it in. Of course, as soon as he was accepted into this crack troop, he immediately joined an officer's course. He was completing that course. He was second in charge in his unit, scheduled to take over. And Alex, besides being a warrior and a very brave man and a hero, he's also an extraordinary poet. He's a beautiful, beautiful human being, an extraordinary person. So I have a bunch of his diaries. And I want to read to you a poem that he wrote as he was getting ready to finish this course to become the commander of one of Israel's top most elite units. August 17th, 1986. Once in a while, as I progress towards the course's end, I feel a pang of fear. If the war comes, when the war comes, I will have to lead men to die. And I will have to have the calm power to yell to them or to whisper, "Kadima, go forward." And I will have to have the calm power to step forward myself. I love Alex because all Alex wants to do is the right thing. His whole life he agonized over whether or not when the moment came he would have the courage to step forward and do the right thing, or would he fold? Would he be under pressure of the values of those around him? Would he give in, or would he stand up and be somebody? He was panicked he would fail. That's a hero. About a year later, on September the 15th, 1987, on Alex's 25th birthday, his special unit was sent to Lebanon to try to stop terrorists in the southern cliffs of Lebanon from tossing Katyushas into the northern communities in Israel. Alex's unit was ambushed. His commander was killed. And my best friend, my hero, achieved his dream. He became the commander of his unit and had to decide, do we abandon the mission or do we go in and try to save the medic who was still under fire? My best friend, my idealist, my hero, made the choice to step forward. And he fell to a terrorist bullet on a rocky hillside in southern Lebanon. I don't have knowledge of what's happening in the smallest Jewish population centers, cities of under 50,000. I do know that in places like Denver, the intermarriage rate is over 70%, Vancouver over 75%. I know there are places in the southeastern part of the United States where the Gentiles are marking places where Jewish communities once flourished as historical sites. There are 625,000 American Jews now practicing other religions. 1 million American Jewish children are being raised with no religion or in another religion. 2 million American Jews today do not give to any Jewish charities or affiliate with any synagogue of any sort. And you have to realize the rot goes much further. Of the 5.5 million Jews in the quote-unquote core group in the United States, almost 4 million have no affiliation whatsoever with anything Jewish. That's a greater percentage of Jews than were lost in the Holocaust. What's even more amazing is there's no panic. There's no uproar. There's no sense of urgency. There's no emergency meetings taking place. So far, 19 Holocaust memorials have been built, 36 centers for the study of the Holocaust. We're pouring millions and millions of dollars into studying dead Jews, and pennies are being allocated for Jewish education for the living. And virtually nobody is responding to our desperate calls, my desperate calls, to please think a second time about our priorities. And I have a theory about why. You have to know historically, this is the first time in 3,300 years of Jewish history when the Jewish community was led by an oligarchy, a group of people who achieved the leadership role virtually only because of the size of their bank accounts. And these people are almost completely ignorant of all Jewish values and certainly all Jewish texts. They know nothing about our history. They know almost nothing about what we stand for. You don't have to be a veteran sociologist to see the writing on the wall. I think that in terms of Jewish communal life as we know it today, it's pretty clear that we are witnessing one of the last generations. I don't know if it's you or your children, but this is it, folks. I just saw a national Jewish population survey that revealed the following. Every year, 2,000 Jews are rescued from the stew of assimilation, become Balei Tshuva, and take on Jewish learning and observance. 2,000 Jews. And every year, about 3,500 become Jews for Jesus. We've got to convey this message to hundreds of thousands of people, to millions of people. We have to tell people about how truly sweet Torah is. The Jewish life abounds with positive, joyous experiences. That Shabbos and the Jewish laws, for instance, governing sexuality, have never been more relevant in 5,000 years of human history. We have to communicate that message with love and with caring and with concern. And above all, with sacrifice. Because if they don't see that we're willing to step forward, even if it costs us, then they know that our product is trash. We've got to make sure that Hitler and the assimilationists fail. We've got to spark a revolution in the United States and across the world. We have to turn on the young. We have to turn on the powerful. We have to restart the whole game. And there's never been a generation that had more power to accomplish such a thing than we. I believe, because there's never been a generation that lived in more darkness than we do. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we've probably got between 10 and 20 years to bring this message across. So there is no time to waste. And almost nobody's willing to help. It's like a bunch of horses running off the edge of a cliff. Or a bunch of people who are so drunk they don't realize they're walking into a gas chamber. If I understand correctly, there are people in this room that are what John F. Kennedy might have called the best and the brightest. You're the cream of the Jewish people. You took time out of your schedules in school to study Judaism. You're interested in leadership. You have fine educations. You're articulate. You're healthy. You're strong. If I was to look someplace on the planet for somebody who could assist, I was told, this is the group I should be speaking to. For the last 2 weeks, I slept about 4 hours a night. And when they told me you were coming, I said, please, please, can I talk to them? I just arrived in the country. But I wasn't going to miss the opportunity because there's somebody here, I think, perhaps, who might be willing to help. Now, what exactly does that mean? It does not mean that you do something crazy. You got to take the next logical step, whatever that is. So what's the next logical step for you? I don't know. I haven't had a chance to speak to you yet. Last week, I met a guy who said the next logical step, he was in the middle of a break. The next logical step for him was, I want to see what made you. And I said, come to yeshiva, and he's on his way. He'll be here next week. He's flying in from California. That was his next logical step. Maybe the next logical step is just start to do something Jewish. Kiddush, once a week, Friday night. Pick up a cup of grape juice and read a blessing out of a siddur. There, you're an affiliated Jew. You're now in the 90th percentile. My God, do you know that 90% of American Jews have never heard the word Shema? They don't know the mantra of Judaism? The Lord is God, the Lord is one? Say Shema, that puts you into the 90th percentile. No one's asking you to do something which is crazy. Do something which is admirable, even by American cultural standards. Kibud av v'em, honoring mother and father, is one of the Ten Commandments. How many people have ever seen the laws? Forget about observing them. How many people have ever seen the laws that relate to honoring mother and father, which happen to be recorded in detail in an English book called the Fifth Commandment? When you stand up and you take a spiritual stance, that transforms people around you. Someone sees you reading a book about honoring mother and father. They say, what are you doing? It's my religion. I'm Jewish. 10 commandments were given at Mount Sinai along with the Torah. I'm not up to the Torah yet. I'm up to the 10 commandments. Or maybe I am up to the Torah. The course that you're in is going to end. Is that the end, then, of Jewish learning? For many people, perhaps most people, maybe that's the end. There's someone I'm speaking to in here right now, and I don't know who it is, for whom that's not the end, who wants to grab a hold of the solution that mankind's been looking for, the solution that transformed mankind historically, that brought the idea to mankind of the sanctity of human life, of the value of a woman, of the rights of children, long before Rousseau was on the scene. Could be there are people here who are willing to take a step forward and start learning Torah. So I don't know, but I came to find out. And therefore, I'd like to conclude with a little experiment. In a few moments, I'm going to ask you, and I don't know who I'm speaking to right now, but I'm going to ask you, you're at the end of your trip. You learned in the United States, you came here, you've been exposed, you heard more than the vast majority of Jews, you know plenty to make a decision if you want to take a step forward. In a few moments, I'm going to ask if there's anybody in this room who now, while you're here in Jerusalem, when you have maximum clarity before everything hits the fan again when you get to the United States, if at this moment you think that you want to make a commitment. And again, I don't know what that commitment is, and that's between you and God, and I don't think it's anyone's business. But the question is, will you be one of those people that says, well, you know, I have to think this over a little bit more? Which is what most of my audiences say most of the time. This is a very complex issue, and this takes time, and you know, I have to consider this very, very deeply, and in a few years, you know, perhaps after graduate school, and I've made a living, and I've got my retirement set, and I'm dead, then I'll work through the issue. Such a cop-out. So what I'm going to ask is, if there's anyone here who's like Alex, or like Hannah, or like Churchill, or like any of those other people who at some point in life stood up and said, ad kan, until here, now I'm making a change. A microscopic change. Because big mountains are built out of thousands and thousands and thousands of little grains of sand. It's not smart to make a sharp right turn in your life, but it's very smart to say, now I start making little steps forward. So I'm going to go ahead and ask. And be honest, and please do not be influenced by social pressure. You shouldn't give a darn what anybody else in the room says. If you can't be brave here, you can't be brave any place. If there's anybody in this room who's thinking, maybe I'm right, and maybe I have to make a commitment now, something small, I'm not going to tell anybody what commitment I made, but something small now. If there's anyone here who thinks, you know, I don't need to think any further for this particular commitment. I'm ready to do this now. If there's anyone like that in this room, who's willing to take a step forward now? Could that person please stand up? thanks. I guess there's a few of you I've got to get to know now. Very good. Thank you very much. I hope we all get to take a step forward together. Don't be strangers. There's a very small community of us, a very small community. Get together. Talk to me. Talk to each other. Notice who stand up and stay close to those people. Those are going to be your best friends for life. It's a very, very narrow road.
That concludes our presentation of Ancient Wisdom for Modern Minds by Lawrence Kellerman. For more tapes by Lawrence Kellerman, visit www.lawrencekellerman.com. That's www.lawrencekellerman.com.